So I'm going to go ahead and introduce our next speaker is Toby C. Toby is an assistant professor in the music industry program at Drexel University in Philadelphia. As an engineer, he's worked on multiple gold and platinum certified recordings, as well as 8 Grammy-winning recordings. He's also the director of Drexel University Audio Archive, and he's going to be speaking with us today about recovering the lost multi-track masters from David Bowie.
Thank you. Title this Recovering Lost. Oh, no, just that one. Yeah, it should be this one here. Oh, hello. Well, let's see here. They say I titled it Lost Masters. I probably should have titled it Stolen Masters. But a little background, I also refer to this as just the events of September 19th through the 24th. A whirlwind 5 days. But a little background, at Drexel University, we were donated the tape vault from the Sigma Sound Studios when they went out of business. What came to us was a little over 6,000 objects, mostly audio tape, a little bit of film, a little bit of video. What this documents is the sound of Philadelphia. These are the musicians, the producers. As you can see, a list of artists here. Gamble and Huff recordings. Gamble and Huff mostly have their recordings, but we have a few things from there. OJ's and Harold Melvin. Donated in 2005. They defaulted on their storage in 2003 and tried to come up with a plan to not have to just throw these out. Luckily, they had the foresight to do that. So we get these in about 2005. They land on Drexel's campus. I was not there yet, and there was no real plan in place other than taking them in. We have them. We have a music industry program. This will be a great place to use these as resources. But there was no facility other than putting them on shelves. Some of the groups, as I mentioned, we have a lot of Patti LaBelle, Teddy Pendergrass, Grover Washington Jr. There's a lot of that. The one that piques many people's eyes is the David Bowie tape. And I say David Bowie tape because there it is. A lot of people, because of this name, will point to the Drexel's collection. It's like, yes, this is where they have the Young American sessions. Well, we have this reel of tape from the Young American sessions. But what is included on this one reel of tape are the basic tracks of what was the Young American sessions. Live vocals, no overdubs, it's just the band and David. To the extent that there's no master on here, none of the things that are on this reel of tape is on the album. So it looks like, when you just look at it, that this might just be production demos. But in essence, it actually was the session tracks, or the start of the session tracks. What brought David to Philadelphia was what I was talking about, the sound of Philadelphia was starting to become really, really popular, and it was identifiable. Sort of like the Funk Brothers, MFSB in Philadelphia had a sound. It was very intriguing to David, and he wanted to capitalize on this for his next project. So in August of 1974, he came to Philadelphia with the hopes to immerse himself in this and use the session players and the facility to put that kind of an imprint on his next project. The tape that we have and the tapes I'm about to talk about include the musicians that are there in bold. Mike Garson, David Sanborn, Carlos Salomar, Willie Weeks, Andy Newmark. One of the things you may notice right away, if you talk about the Sound of Philadelphia, none of these people are Philadelphia players, except for Larry Washington. Larry Washington, who isn't on these tapes, was overdubbed later, the only member of MFSB that played on these sessions. So, a whole other presentation to go into there. But it was a very uncomfortable situation. The Philadelphia community wasn't too enamored with lending their sound to an outsider. And I've heard stories, just anecdotally, that David was fairly treated badly in his time here. I don't know for that for sure. I've never heard that from the source. But here we have what's going on here. So he comes to Philadelphia, starts trying to put together a band, has to bring everybody down from New York. And over the course of the time, you'll see the band kind of build. The reel of tape I have is tape number 4. So they're 4 days in, and all these people are there. Turns out on reel number 1, they're not all entirely there. And it's not entirely, I've been told that the first day that the producer, Tony Visconti, wasn't even there. That really David was the only one kind of running the show. And you kind of get a sense of that when you listen to the reels, the talking in between takes. His presence is definitely felt. He's pretty much running the show. Now, what this brings me to is September 19th, 2009. Reel of tape shows up on eBay. David Bowie original Sigma Sound tapes, recording reel. Opening bid, $15,000. By the way, there's another one that we'll be selling later. One of a kind, includes unreleased material. This got the attention of a number of people. The first person it got the attention of was David Bowie. The first call I got was from his manager, saying, "I thought you had these. What's going on?" Almost simultaneously, I get an email from someone I don't know, and I'm going to refer to her by her screen name, which is Mixie. Mixie is involved in a online forum called soulfulplanet.com. So we'll have a number of slides with that logo here for a reason. Soulful Planet is an online community of fans and creators of soul music. There's a number of forums that are divided by city, including a lot of the players that played on a lot of these records are members of this forum. So they were an interesting resource because they knew all about this. Turns out Mixie worked at Sigma Sound during the time of these sessions. This caught her attention. Basically, the distress call, what's going on? Why are these showing up on eBay? I thought you had them. So I had to do a little damage control. One, to the online forum, your Bowie's management's been notified. Actually, they notified me. I did report it to eBay, and I reported it to the RIAA. To this day, I've yet to get a response from either one of them. And I had to assure them that, look, now my aim is to protect and preserve this collection, but I have what I have. The session was in 1974. We got the collection in 2005. A little bit of time for things to disappear. So a lot of discussion went back and forth to kind of put everyone to ease. Once I got that, I found a very vibrant community that was very impassioned about protecting artists' rights and their creative work. So I dug into this, and I tried to look for an explanation as best as I could. Institutional Advancement Department at Drexel gave me a 50-page copy of a Xerox of a fax of a printout, could barely read it, that was the initial inventory before donation. And it turns out of the inventory list, there lists three reels. So you can already do the math. I have one, and there's two on eBay. But what arrived at Drexel was that one reel of tape that we have. So somewhere, now at least we know when it disappeared, those two tapes disappeared, somewhere between they counted them downtown, they delivered them to us, two tapes are gone. Now, and Steve Smoling did the assessment, so he has probably some background knowledge on this that I don't. Yeah, but this is what I'm going off of what I've been given at this point. And I do have some theories beyond them disappearing before they arrived at Drexel. But that's another discussion. The seller tells the community that, or tells the on his eBay ad that he bought these at a street sale in Philadelphia. Not sure what that means, but so here we are, an interested group of people worried about these tapes. How can we get them back? But none of us really have any claim to this. David Bowie owns his masters. He was one of those artists that was either really well advised or really smart to be really well advised to own his masters from the very beginning. And he, to this day, has everything except for two albums. He cannot figure out where Young Americans went and where some of these other things went. But this vibrant online community says, we got to do something about this. So Mixie and some others come up with a plan that let's pose as an interested buyer and see what data we can collect, hand it over to Bowie's management, and let their lawyers do what they can do. Or we can use that information to scare the seller into returning the tapes. Now, again, I had to keep telling the online community, we have no power to absolve the guy if he gives back the tapes. We don't have any power to say, okay, bring them back and you're fine. But we can do what we can do. Turns out she contacted the seller, asked him a number of questions, said she represented a collector, but wasn't sure what a 2-inch reel tape, multi-track tape would do, and why is it so expensive? Well, it's so expensive because there's unreleased material here. And I've already transferred it to make sure that it's unique and it's, it's according to him. So we're collecting all the copyright violations he's done at this point. He even gives her a link to YouTube to where she can listen to samples. Which at one point she replies, well, if I can just get it from YouTube, why would I pay $15,000 for it? So, with Mr. Bowie's permission, we post this on the forum. We know who you are. She came back one day with an email to me saying, here's his name, here's where he lives, here's where he works, here's where he went to school. I was like, how in the world? She's like, well, my current job is in loss prevention. All right. So we post this. And give him the option. We basically said, look, we can't absolve you of any deeds. If they want to take legal action, they can. But you can bring these back to a certain place, which would be my office, basically. So, September 24th, I arrive at work. There are two reels of tape sitting on my desk, along with some transfers of these tapes. I send along that information to Mr. Bowie's management. They're thrilled. What they have done beyond this for legal action, I have no idea. Yes, he would be chuffed to bits. Now, here's what I got. 216 track reels, tape one, tape two. Notice the big Dolby A stickers. When the seller transferred these, that wasn't done, so it really sounded horrendous. Here we can see what was on it. John, I'm Only Dancing Again, a complete take. Can You Hear Me? It's Going to Be Me. There's the track sheet. All of these are pretty similar. Bass drum, snare, stereo drums, guitar, Fender Rhodes, clavinet, vocal, or if it's not Fender Rhodes, it's grand piano. And the live vocal is David singing live. That's reel one. This is reel two. Retakes of Young American, only the one of them complete. Shilling the Rubes. This has never been released on anything. This is the big, well, you can now search the internet and find it, thanks to our eBay seller. I Am a Laser, which was released not on Young Americans, but later and after today. Same track set up, but notice day two, by the time they get to I Am a Laser, David Sanborn shows up, so now there's a sax. Now, I think it's my next slide is going to have some audio snippets of this, if I have time to play. Those are from just rough mixes from the 2-inch that I did a transfer before I then immediately FedEx the tapes back to Mr. Bowie. But the point of this, that this entire event, as much as copyright is a pain in most of our sides on a daily basis for a preservation standpoint, in this case, it really helped to tighten screws on this person who was selling these tapes. But the most important thing was all of a sudden I had a connection with a community that I should have long since had. The community that loves and created this music is a huge, huge resource that I had not tapped into at this point. Now that I have, I really understand how valuable they are. And don't upset Mixie. She'll find you. One last thing I want to leave you with. At the end of reel number two, end of the song, David Sanborn has an exclamation.
Oh, let's do it again, man. Let's do it again right now. Please. Can we for me?
So if you run across reel number three, they take it one more time for him. Hope to see that some point in the future. Thank you. Any questions? Yes.
When I was working on this appraisal, the Bowie tape was in the office rather than on the shelf. The office I was working in. At that point, I looked for, and other people looked for, more Bowie tapes. And none was there, even though it was in the inventory.
Okay. So it disappeared before. Right.
And then got swiped. They were gone before.
Yeah, here's something that I've heard some anecdotes about. Tom Moulton, who is all over these tapes that in the Sigma Sound collection, considered the father of the 12-inch single. He comes down all the time, just hangs out, listens to stuff, tells me what's what. Great resource. He said these tapes, and he said that he saw all three in the office that you're speaking of. And the then owner of the building said, these are probably worth a lot of money. But he said at that point there were three, and a neighbor in my neighborhood who runs a small studio had mentioned that he had bought tapes at Sigma prior to donation out the back door. So right.
That they had contacted various record companies. Gamble Help came in and bought a lot of their stuff back at some nominal price for him to recover some cash out of it. And that the people from RCA were notified that these were there and declined to come down and get them.
Yes. That's the only way we were able to get them, was by the remainder of the tapes that we got, the record labels saying no. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Because Tom got word of this pretty quickly too and came. Yeah. Any other questions?
Joe and Mike Tarzi don't have anything to shed upon.
I talked to Mike. He called me. Said, what's going on? I hear all this stuff's going on. This is long after it already happened and we'd recovered it. He claims no knowledge of anything. I don't know.
Do you sit, just browsing eBay now?
Well, I never thought I would, but I kind of do. The interesting thing was the first person to contact us immediately was Bowie's management, because Bowie himself was surfing eBay and found it. Because I'm sure there's plenty of stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
The time that they came to Drexel, Sigma was bankrupt and they were owned by the owner of the warehouse. Is that the chain?
Yes. Yes. They had gone out of business. They had ceased operations a while before. They were housing the tapes, and then they defaulted. Yeah. And so the Penn Dion Corporation owned the building and took possession of the tapes in lieu of renting the space. But then he eventually wanted to gut the space and use it, so he wanted to get rid of the tapes somehow.
So they did have a legal right to sell whatever they wanted.
To
wear
customs.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Yeah.
And they did their due diligence. They did contact the people. They were very honest about it. We had this discussion. Because the title to what's being donated has to be clear.
Yes.
So you mentioned copyright law in your conclusion. So
yes.
I'm curious if ownership of the tapes was clearly established and investigated. So is the ownership of the tapes but not of the material on the tape?
Right. David Bowie owns the material that's on the tape.
And all three reels are now back to David Bowie?
Yes.
Okay. So you had reel one that belonged to David Bowie and had it in your archive?
Well, and that was fine with him. And that's what most artists that I've that know, they are like, that's fine. We don't have any place to put the tape. You hold on to it. Can we have a transfer? And so I had already done that transfer of the reel we had for him. And so then I just did these other two, and he's like, I'll just go ahead and take the tapes.
Now,
so.
What's also interesting is that you receive CDs from somebody of the 16 tracks.
Yes.
That means whoever had them had a 16-track player.
That's what we thought. That's what we thought it too, because he claimed, I don't know, you know, what to, you know, what these, he claimed kind of ignorance on some parts of it, but, and I was like, well, how do you have a 16-track machine? He hired a studio in town to transfer them for him.
It could be done on a 24-track.
Yeah, and it can't be done, and that's what it was. It was done on a 24-track without Dolby A. Sounded lovely. Yes? Yes.
Make mixes but not sell them on eBay.
Well, yes, sort of, yes. I mean, if for the most part, when we do use stuff for class content, we make sure that it's okay. And we have our legal general counsel on top of that pretty hard, having students sign waivers and knowing that we know if anything gets out, we can at least come back to the students if they're enrolled. So. We're pretty lucky in the fact that our general counsel pretty much says, let's go for it, because we don't think we're going to get any lawsuit issues here because of the nature of how we go about it. And so far, so good. All right, anything else? Yes?
Did anything happen to the seller, or was it just...
Don't know. I think not. I don't think so, but I don't know. I'm not privy to that. Once the tapes came back and we went and I sent it back to Bo, I've not heard anything further. Not that they need to tell me anything, so I don't know if anything else has happened. There was a point when I had even just told his management, it's like, why don't you buy the tapes? That way at least you'll know who the seller is, and then you can go after them. Before we had a scare tactic, and we knew before we knew who the person was. And it turns out that the person was fairly young, music fan, probably did buy them at a street sale. Turns out he's been pretty forthcoming with info. But not that he owes us any info. All right. Thank you.
I'd like to thank all three of our panelists today. That was a really spectacular set of presentations. Thank you all.